Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, right here on Revolution Radio Studio B, this fifth day of February, 2024. I do have a featured guest, Kevin Barrett, who will be joining us from Morocco at the top of the second hour. Meanwhile, senators have released a package of border policies and aid for Ukraine and Israel, but it's completely outrageous. It basically legalizes illegal immigration. Stunning stuff. Here's Zero Hedge addressing it. Scandalous Senate deal allows 1.5 million illegals per year, slides up to 2.3 billion to NGOs trafficking them, and gives 60 billion to Ukraine. While the House has gone full Israel or bust, the Senate had come up with a $118 billion bipartisan agreement that would allow 1.5 million illegals to enter the U.S. every year, allocating $2.3 billion toward NGOs and other organizations that traffic them. In other words, paying those for bringing in all these illegals into the United States, giving $14.1 billion security assistance to Israel and a whopping $60 billion more for Ukraine. Here you have Greg Price tweeting, not only does this bill codify, meaning make legal, 1.5 million illegal border crossings into law, but the border emergency that automatically is implemented at 5,000 crossing per day in a week can be overturned by Biden. In a case, 1.5 million illegals isn't enough. It also locks in green card giveaways through 2030. I mean, this is about as disgusting as it gets. The agreement was reached by Senator James Lankford, a Republican of Oklahoma, whose own state legislature censured him last week for striking such a crappy border deal, along with Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, and Kristen Sinema, Independent of Arizona. Here we have the real fly tweeting it. Pretty amazing. We're at a point where like 5,000 illegals into this country is going to become law. Let's pause to revisit the fact that President Biden could close the border with a stroke of a pen right now, but refuses to do so until Ukraine and Israeli money materializes. He really liked quid pro quo arrangements, you see. Here's Kyle Becker. By the way, if at any moment Joe Biden doesn't like the border emergency declaration, he can end it at will. That's actually in the bill. As noted, it carves out a $2.33 billion for refugees and entrant assistance, which provides an account made available under this heading in the act, maybe used for grants or contracts with qualifying organizations, including nonprofit entities, to provide culturally and linguistically appropriate services, in other words, to facilitate the invasion. Breaking it down further, the 118.28 billion national security supplemental package includes 60.06 billion to support Ukraine, 14.1 billion in security assistance to Israel, 2.44 billion to support operations by U.S. Central Command. That has to do with the Red Sea op against the Houthis, which is totally illegal because the Houthis have been acting in accordance with international law, have declared war on Israel. We're only interdicting ships with cargo bound for Israel, all of which is in accordance with the laws of war. $10 billion in humanitarian assistance for food, water, shelter, medical care for civilians in Gaza and the West Bank, Ukraine, and other population. $4.83 billion to support key regional partners in the Indo-Pacific. $2.33 billion to continue support for Ukraine. $20.23 billion to address existing operational needs and expand our capabilities at our nation border. $400 million for the nonprofit security grant program to help nonprofits in places of worship make security arrangements. All that's window dressing, mind you. What's really going on here is to legalize illegal immigration. Meanwhile, the Lankford plan helps Biden migration, hinders Trump crackdown. Do you have any doubt about it? Senator James Lankford border proposal helps Joe Biden import more migrants and hinders President Donald Trump from reducing the inflow, says Rosemary Jinks at the Immigration Accountability Project. The key problem is the so-called trigger authorization that automatically curbs migration, since once 8,500 arrive at the border in one day or 5,000 7 days in a row. This new trigger covertly would override an existing emergency law that allows the president to shut down the border at much lower levels of illegal immigration. So this is Congress establishing that a border emergency is either 4,000 or 5,000 counters per day or 5,000 migrants over a seven-day average and 8,500 in a day when you really, really shut down the border. So these three numbers are what establishes in the law what qualifies as an emergency. So say Trump were elected. He comes in and says there are 2,000 migrants encountered every single day. I'm declaring emergency, shutting down the border. Then the court says, no, no, no. Congress passed a law that says it's got to be 4,500 to 8,500. Yet advocates, including Lankford and Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who strongly supports more labor migration, describe the trigger as a key feature of the proposal. So if Trump were to become president, this would be new authorities that he had actually asked for what he was when he was president before. Bullshit. Biden makes the same claim. It would give me, President, a new emergency authority to shut down the border when it becomes overwhelmed. If given that authority, I would use it the day I signed the bill into law. Just rubbish. The plan was drafted under the direction of Mitch McConnell, head of the GOP caucus. Many GOP senators opposed the giveaway to Biden, however. Trump also opposed the plan. There is zero chance I will support this horrible open border betrayal of America, he said January 27th. I'll tell you what, I'd rather have no bill than a bad bill. He's got it exactly right. Meanwhile, check this out. The clergy plan is well underway by Chris Langan. Here he lays it out.
You mentioned the grave replacement as an issue. I mean, how grave do you see this issue? What do you think the consequences, the long-term consequences of the Great Replacement are?
Well, I think the long-term consequences are the having the majority populations of North America and Europe and Australia and New Zealand diluted out of existence. I think basically if you're going to take, you know, 7 billion people, only, you know, 300 or 400 million of which are white, and mix them all together, you know, and the non-white ones breed a lot faster than the white ones do, pretty soon you're not going to have anything resembling a white person anymore. Now, what happens then? Well, that individualism and that particular creative kind of abstraction that whites tend to excel in, that disappears. And then what you've got is a homogeneous sort of, it's an ideal slave race for people who have mastered the techniques of control. Okay, and so we've got these Bernaysian techniques of control and all kinds of surveillance and coercion technology, and political science has gotten to be, you know, nothing but a demonic scam, more or less, where people are being fooled, and, you know, consent is being manufactured. Now that's where we're headed. And it's basically, this was written about, by the way, by Richard N. Putin of Kalergi, who came up with something called the Kalergi Program, wrote a book called Practical Idealism that was funded by, I believe it was the Warburgs and Rothschilds, you know, back in 1925. And it had been going on before that. I mean, it goes way the hell back to the earliest, you know, roots of Zionism and communism. But that book was written in 1925 with funding from these central bankers. And it advocates basically for what it is now EU immigration policy, and what, after it became EU immigration policy, which is namely shipping in all the non-whites, it became North American immigration policy as well. So that's what we're faced with now. Basically, the activation of the Kalergi program under the supervision of central bankers who are paying off our governments and our leaders to turn against us and actually replace us with other populations, and basically dilute our genome out of existence in a kind of a vast mocha-colored, what did Kalergi call it, the Eurasian Negroid race of the future. And yeah, by the way, he had, basically Kalergi spoke of two races, this Eurasian Negroid race of the future, kind of mongrelized, mocha-colored hodgepodge, and then you've got, you know, the master race. It wasn't Hitler who came up with that terminology. That was Kalergi. Okay? The master race. And of course, the master race was to consist of whom? It was to consist of Zionist bankers and the European nobility who were their most lucrative clients. And it's as simple as that. That's what they wanted. A master race, right? For downbreeding everybody else into a kind of slave race. And that's what it's been about since that time. Ever since then, the history of the world has conformed to this program, to this agenda, in every way. And people still aren't breaking up. There's no continuity. I mean, you know, basically the book was taken off the shelves in Germany, you know, and now, you know, people deny it. It's just, oh, it's a big conspiracy theory. Nonsense. But this agenda has been pushed, and pushed hard for a long time, and it is in full swing. The EU, the European Union, would not exist without it.
Yeah, it seems like the brakes are off now. You know, there was a time where this was denied in most Western countries. We were told it was a small trickle of immigration. It was just a workforce. And now they ramp it up. You know, you don't see white people in TV shows. You don't see white people in movies. You have old Shakespeare plays with black casts. You have advertising that's just constantly pushing.
Yeah, my wife and I were watching TV that we have an internet service, and we were trying to watch a movie, but it was on one of these services, I think IMDb, that has commercials that come across. And there was a string of five commercials, each one of them with almost nothing but black people in it. I mean, what the hell do you call that? Yeah, you know, I mean, what is that about? I mean, they're trying to sell products, one would think, to the majority citizens of the nation in which the show is being televised. And yet here, every single commercial features non-whites. What is that about? Well, obviously, we're being conditioned. We're being demoralized. They want us to be dissatisfied with being white. And the irony is that if this agenda continues, pretty soon there's going to be no more diversity. Diversity will be completely homogenized out of existence. Everybody will look the same. They'll have the same mocha-colored skin tone, the same attitudes, the same cultural values, everything is going to be just totally broken down so that nobody opposes their leaders, which is this, you know, Kalergian master race of which I spoke.
Now, you mentioned, I mean, another factor is, yeah, decline in IQ. And I mean, you can just look at demographic studies, and basically the people that are having the most kids now are the lower IQ population. Also, the high IQ population has more kids. Basically, the people in the middle are kind of, there's a collapse there. But again, the lower section of that is having far more kids than
And you also got to cut off the highest section of IQ too. The people with the highest IQs are not breeding at all. Okay, those people, you know, some of them, a few of them, especially the ones that are lower down and more materialistic, devote themselves to their careers. But, you know, people like me, for example, I was completely stopped from being able to afford a family when I was, you know, at the age when I wanted to. And I actually was trying to get a job and accumulate enough money. Cost of living was high where I was living, which was in New York. But I actually, you know, made an effort to, you know, settle down, get a steady paying job so that I could raise a family. I could not do it. Why couldn't I do it? Because the civil service, which was basically the only thing where I could, you know, hope to be hired. You go and you take the test. If you're a white person, you can score 100 on the civil service exam, or at the time could score 100 on the civil service exam in New York and be beaten by any non-white with a score of 70.
Whoa.
They're spotted 30% on the same test. So you end up with, you know, 3,000-4,000 non-white people in front of you for any civil service job at the time. So there was just, I saw there was no way to do it. So yeah, they stopped people like me from breeding. I mean, I didn't have any connections, didn't have any money. Someone in my position is completely, it doesn't make any difference what the genetic quality is. They don't care. They'll cut you off, okay? And meanwhile, you know, these people that were getting the jobs, you know, the non-whites who were getting the jobs, I was in a post office one time. It was in Spionk, New York. Okay, standing in the post office, and there was a guy in there. He was a black guy, and he was saying hi to somebody else he knew. And, you know, the guy said, you know, hey, you know, how are the kids doing? He says, you know, I got a lot of kids. And the guy says, yeah, just exactly how many kids do you have? And he said, by my count, about 40. Okay, he basically had this guy, the black guy, was bragging about having, and he was by no, you know, no great shakes intellectually. I mean, you could tell I had to estimate his IQ. He was maybe 75. Bragging about having 40 kids with a wide assortment of women. And the guy said, geez, you know, you got to be stupid to have that many kids. He says, oh, no, the government pays us to. Those words came out of his mouth. The government pays us to. And that's true. That's absolutely true. So you've got these low IQ people that are being paid to breed. And not just breed a little, but breed a lot. And then you've got people like me who are totally X'd out of the economy. So that we can't afford to raise a family. This is not just accidental. This is, you know, it's basically dysgenic. Somebody is trying to damage our genome. And they're doing a very, very good job.
I think he's got it exactly right. Meanwhile, Josh Hawley and the DHS ad Mayorkas had a rather heated exchange during a Senate hearing.
Let's what about people out. Who say things like, on October the 7th, F Israel, I'm cleaning up the language here, F Israel, the government and its military, are you ready for your downfall? People who say things like F Israel and any Jew who supports Israel. May your conscience haunt your dreams until your last breath. Palestine will be free one day. F apartheid Israel and is any Israeli. What, this is pretty extreme rhetoric, don't you think?
I do, and I think there is a distinction between espousing or endorsing terrorist ideology and speech that is odious, that does not rise to that level.
Fair enough. This person works for you. This is Nuja Ali, an employee of the Department of Homeland Security, who posted these comments on October the 7th. That's not all she posted. She also posted this graphic. Now, this is a fake graphic, I want to be clear, but I think we understand it. This is a paraglider, a Hamas paraglider, depicted here with a machine gun flying into Israel. She posted it under her online alias with the celebratory Free Palestine. Mr. Secretary, what's going on here? Is this typical of people who work at DHS? This is an asylum and immigration officer who is posting these frankly pro-genocidal slogans and images on the day that Israelis are being slaughtered in their beds. What have you done about this?
Four things I'd like to say to you. Number one, your question to suggest that that is emblematic of the men and women of the Department of Homeland Security is despicable.
What have you done? This person works for the Department of Homeland Security. Have you fired her?
That was one of four answers.
Have you fired her?
One.
Have you fired her? Don't come to this hearing room when Israel has been invaded and Jewish students are barricaded in libraries in this country and cannot be escorted out because they are threatened for their lives. You have employees who are celebrating genocide, and you are saying it's despicable for me to ask the question? Has she been fired?
Mr. Secretary.
After the consumption of Senator Hawley's time, I'd like to speak.
Has she been fired?
Because I will
an answer. Would you?
Because I will not be given the opportunity.
Has she been fired?
So that individual has been placed on administrative leave.
So she's not been fired.
Number two.
Why has she not been fired?
Number two, the individual was hired in 2019.
Why has she not been fired?
Number three, I cannot speak to an ongoing personnel matter.
Why has this person not been fired? Your answer is you can't speak to it? This isn't sufficient to fire her?
I am not in a position to speak to an ongoing personnel matter.
This isn't sufficient to fire her? That's what you're telling me?
That is not what I'm saying.
But she's still on your payroll as we sit here today.
That is not what I'm saying.
She's still on your payroll as we sit here today.
Senator?
How many cases? She was an asylum and immigration officer. How many cases?
Well, I find it rather surprising. Actually, I was given the impression that during that exchange, Mayorkas was appealing to the fact that he comes from a family of Holocaust survivors and playing the ultimate victim card. Frankly, I think Hawley was off base. I mean, here you had someone who was speaking up for Hamas and against Israeli genocide, and I think Hawley missed the boat. Meanwhile, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene talking about impeaching Mayorkas. Here we got something with her. Listen.
Now, House Republicans moving forward with two articles of impeachment against DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. They are accusing him of one, willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law, and two, breach of public trust. Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene leading the charge. She joins us now. Marjorie, what's going to happen here? Votes tomorrow. Is this going to be an actual impeachment vote or an impeachment inquiry? And how does this negotiation with the White House muddle up the Mayorkas story?
Well, thank you for asking, Larry. Tomorrow on our Homeland Security Committee, we will actually be marking up articles of impeachment that were referred to my committee in Homeland after I had forced a floor vote back in November. So this is something that I've been pushing and working on for a long time. This is what the American people want to see happen. And coupling it with the fact that we have the federal government pitted against the state of Texas and 25 Republican governors standing with Texas of this unprecedented border invasion brought on by Secretary Mayorkas and his willful willingness to basically break federal immigration law can't come soon enough. I'm very proud. Republicans will be voting yes tomorrow on my articles of impeachment and the articles of impeachment that we have shaped together. And we will be hopefully bringing that to the House floor for a vote very soon.
Well, nobody's pushed this harder than you have. You know, not enforcing the law, but also breaking the public trust. I mean, that's a very important thing, breaking the public trust. Everybody knows there was a massive problem and breakdown. And Mayorkas and his boss, Biden, you know, presidents never lie, Marjorie. They just have cognitive dissonance or they just have untruths. So we've been faced with this massive untruth for 3 years. Now it's time to take an accounting.
Well, they can't trick the American people, Larry. And you and I both know this is horrific. month after month, that's another historic number of invasions. December was the highest number, but we can't watch Americans die every single day from fentanyl overdose and illegal alien crime. You know, it's members of Congress. We're the lawmakers, not the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. And Secretary Mayorkas has taken it into his hands to make this border invasion possible. He's paroled illegal aliens en masse into the country. Here we have, you know, tragically, three members of the Georgia Reserves killed in this awful attack that we've just learned about. You know, I think those reservists would rather be guarding our southern border and protecting our homeland than tragically getting killed because of Biden's weakness and horrific foreign policy that's led to this attack.
Yes, ma'am. That's all I can say. Yes, ma'am. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, thank you ever so much. We appreciate it. All right.
Thanks. And I got to get back on the air. I'll call you right back.
Well, that's pretty good for Marjorie Taylor Greene, in my opinion. She's a hero, a real American. We have a problem now with a dispute in Europe, in Ukraine, between the head of the Ukrainian armed forces, whom I believe was actually killed in Ukraine in Kiev during a Russian missile strike, whom Zelensky has replaced, and the new head of the Ukrainian armed services. We're going to take a good look at that, but we're heading up to the break. Let's start. Let's see what we can figure out. Here's about Russian forces, you know, expanding, taking a great cost for Kiev, for Ukraine. There's lots of videos from South Front, which is really excellent, in covering the war. And I'm impressed by what they are doing here, the Russians, of course, but they've been very... We'll be right back.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, the Washington Post has revealed details of a dispute between Zaluzhny, the head of the armed forces, and Zelensky on conscripting 500,000 more into the armed forces of Ukraine. Those who have been following the reporting know that the Ukrainians have lost a staggering 500,000 in only 2 years. Just a contrast, in all the years we were in Vietnam, we only lost about 50,000. And what was that, 12 years, 14? Now in two, they've lost 10 times that many. The Washington Post, citing Ukrainian official, revealed details of the conflict between President Zelensky and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, Zaluzhny, about the need to mobilize another 500,000 for the armed forces of Ukraine. Frankly, they don't have 500,000 to recruit. They're putting old men and kids on the front lines now, frequently with no training whatsoever, so they are rapidly dispatched, adding to the staggering number of deaths. A high-ranking Ukrainian official, familiar with a meeting, told the Washington Post that Zaluzhny, in a conversation with Zelensky, emphasized Ukraine should call up at least as many as Russia plans to recruit into the armed forces, 400,000. According to the military man, Ukraine needs a large-scale conscription, he really means, if it wants to win on the battlefield, because the Russian Federation has more forces and more weapons. In addition, Mr. Looney warned that Russia and Ukraine should prepare for losses comparable to last year. Now, the fact is they don't have the manpower to maintain the war. They have actually lost the war. They're carrying it on only for the sake of politics. There are lots of other developments here that are very, very bad. Meanwhile, the West has been carrying out retaliatory strikes on Iranian-linked militia targets in Iraq and Syria. This is the United States now. Officially, we oughtn't to be having any role here whatsoever, but unofficially, of course, we're committing violations of international law, national sovereignty. Here's CNN reporting. U.S. carries out retaliatory strikes on Iranian-linked militia targets in Iraq and Syria. The U.S. conducted major airstrikes, this was like Saturday, on 85 targets across 7 locations in Iraq and Syria on Friday, the start of what will likely be a series of larger-scale U.S. strikes on Iranian-backed militias who have carried out attacks on U.S. troops in the Middle East. Actually, this is not a question of attacks on U.S. troops. This is a question of the U.S. forces being deployed to benefit Israel. The retaliatory strikes, which lasted 30 minutes and were successful, according to the White House, came in response to a drone strike by Iranian-backed militants on a U.S. outpost in Jordan on Sunday, which killed 3 U.S. service members and wounded more than 40 others. Yes. There was such a strike. Yes, 3 servicemen were killed. But the fact of the matter is that we shouldn't be there anyway. It's absolutely outrageous. Here's a wonderful depiction of the big picture here from Colonel McGregor.
Folks, just want to take a moment
Yeah.
Thanks for your support today.
And they kick in ads.
It might as well say the Middle East, but primarily we're trying to forge a path to war with Iran because that's what the Israeli state wants. And to be frank with you, we have no strategy towards the region. We have no policy. What we are essentially are instruments of Israeli national policy. And we take our instructions from them because we have no interest in supporting this campaign to effectively expel or kill all Palestinian Arabs in Gaza and ultimately also in the West Bank. And that's effectively what is now begun by the Israelis. We certainly don't have an interest in a war with Hezbollah or Iran, contrary to what many politicians are telling the American people. So I think the biggest problem right now is that the mainstream media, the financial sector, and the government are all 100% behind this unconditional support for Israel. And they are proselytizing in favor of that. Most Americans really aren't paying attention, as we've discussed before. I think Americans are rightly focused on the border. They're definitely seeing that. And that's why you're seeing the left now under Biden and in general, the Washington swamp change its tune. They're starting to say, we want to close the border. We just have to come to a compromise. Oh, that's a lot of nonsense. We all know that. And that should have happened years ago. Now people are openly discussing military power on the border. That should have happened years ago as well. We did that for 100 years from 1846 to 1948. There are reasons for all of that. But the bottom line is we're no better off. So in the meantime, it's a case of watch what this hand does, but don't pay attention to the other hand. And now that we've had this attack on, it was actually, as I am told, designed to hit Al-Tanf, which is a large American base inside Syria. The watchtower that was struck and the Americans who were wounded or killed were just literally on the other side of the border in Jordan. But that was not originally the target. And remember, the Jordanian government has approved our presence in their country. The Syrian government has not. So we are illegally inside Syria. And those soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are involved in Iraq and Syria, they have no mission except to essentially improve security for Israel, which is laughable because if anybody knows more about what's happening in Syria and Iraq than we do, it's the Israelis. Their intelligence is excellent. And then secondly, a little bit of oil that is squeaking through the system from Turkey into Israel is pretty much going to stop. Mr. Erdogan has dragged his feet on it, but very shortly the Israelis will be without any oil or natural gas anyway. And we are very vulnerable. And to be blunt, if the Iranians had done this, they would have hit us. This would not have been an accident. They have precise tactical and theater ballistic missiles. We're dealing with Arab militias. The Houthis are an Arab militia. The Shiite Arabs in Iraq are part of militias. That's what you've got in Hezbollah. All of these people are Arabs. And even though they may be Shiites, they are in solidarity with Arabs in Gaza. And as long as we do what we're doing in Gaza, which is to provide limitless quantities of supply for the Israelis in terms of ammunition, spare parts, aircraft, intelligence, even now we have lots of Americans in uniform on the ground in Israel. As long as we continue to underwrite this terrible policy, we're going to be attacked by Arabs in the Middle East. It's very simple. Now, we made a terrible mistake with the Houthis because we beat our chests and said, we will punish the Houthis. We will defeat the Houthis. The Houthis have turned out to be a lot tougher to take on than we imagined, which any of us who knew anything about the region knew to begin with. That is terrible terrain. It's very difficult to run around and identify the targets, find the active missile systems and the fighters, and do any damage. And these people have been through years of warfare with Saudi Arabia and us. Remember, we backed the Saudis. This produced a terrible famine in Yemen that killed hundreds of thousands and did enormous damage. These people are hardened to it. They're ready to fight and fight. And they're going to do whatever they can to make us miserable until we change our policy. So if you want this to stop, Americans need to answer the question. Are we comfortable supporting Israel's policy in Gaza? If we're comfortable with what they're doing as a nation, then that's fine. The government should make it abundantly clear what we're doing. And that means we've got almost 500,000 Arabs living inside the Gaza Strip that have no homes, nothing over their heads, not enough to eat, suffering from all sorts of diseases as a result of bad water, have no power. And everyone in Israel is celebrating because they want to eliminate these people. They see them, after all, as is being told repeatedly, as animals that deserve to be expelled, expunged, exterminated. Interesting. Are we comfortable with that? I don't think most Americans are. But most Americans are not being told the truth. They don't really see what's happening. So we have no policy. We have no foreign policy. Our armed forces are now essentially the pawns of Israel and whatever Israel's lobby in the United States wants. And remember, the Israeli lobby has almost complete control of everyone on the Hill. And they also control the thinking and the policy making. But beyond that, what happens in the media? And the media crushes anyone who speaks up and says, perhaps this is not a good idea. Then you are branded as an anti-Semite. The ad hominem attacks begin. If they can, they attack your sources of income. They try to disenfranchise you, destroy your bank accounts, and so forth. This is the way things are played right now in the United States. That's why I say this is not American foreign policy. This is Israeli foreign policy. And that's what's running the show.
Yeah. Coming back to some American.
That's such a brilliant summation. And, of course, confirms what I've been suggesting for some time now, namely, if you want to understand what's going on in the U.S. today, just envision Benjamin Netanyahu is our commander-in-chief in regard to foreign policy, and George Soros, who appears to have bought the DNC lock, stock, and barrel, is our domestic. For Soros, of course, has made it his dream to see America destroyed during his lifetime, and where the open border policy is an absolutely crucial element thereof. And where Netanyahu, of course, wants to use U.S. forces to complete the 9/11 project. On this specific point, I think Paul Craig Roberts has it right, that this business of, you know, mopping up the Palestinians, killing them or exporting them all out of Israel, but also the pseudo-attacks on American forces in Syria to justify American strikes on Hezbollah and on other Iran-allied forces in Syria is meant to complete the project. Remember, Wesley Clark explained at the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco in October of 2007 that Rumsfeld had sent out the order to take out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Libya and Iraq, ending with Syria and Iran, where Syria was only, it was off to a fast start, but then Syria became a problem because of the introduction of Russian and Iranian forces at the request of the democratically elected president of Syria. So now I think the idea is to complete the project and to do it with American forces, right? You've heard me say, and it's only semi-humorous, that the Israeli national anthem is Onward Christian Soldiers. They want to use Christians, whom they despise, by the way, to do their dirty work. And they want the whole thing to be paid for, fought for by the United States. Meanwhile, we have over 100,000 killed, wounded, or missing in Gaza. Part of the reason they're missing is the Israelis are creating mass burial sites in burying corpses there. We have a funding freeze for the only UN agency that actually assists the Palestinian refugees. Here we have a nice illustration of the points being made by Colonel McGregor, to wit, Benjamin Netanyahu shows Biden who's boss. Check this out. There's so much here. This is now Phil Giraldi on with Judge Napolitano.
The report in 30 days was a vote of 16-1 with the Israeli appointed justice joining the 16. Do you think there's any implication for the United States becoming a co-defendant in this case because of its unabashed supplying of the instruments of genocide?
Well, you know, I've been reading a lot of analysis from people who understand legal issues a lot better than I do, and judicial issues, and they're kind of coming down all over the map, but are essentially saying that yes, the United States is complicit in these genocide leading type actions that the Israelis are engaged in. And that would mean the money that's being given to Israel to fight the war, the weapons that are being delivered and described as emergency defense weapons for Israel, but they're in fact being used to carry out the bombing and strafing of Gaza, killing. What bothers me is we've got another month till this alleged report comes out, which, of course, Israel will deny everything. And every day the bombing continues, the famine continues, the disease continues. There are anywhere from 300 to 500 Palestinians, mostly women and children, who are dying every single day while this process plays out. So that's what I think upsets me most about it. I would have liked to have seen either, since they won't accept a ceasefire, how about another one of these pauses, maybe to gain a little sanity in what's going on there.
Here's President Biden speaking about his plans to potentially retaliate against Iran because he says Iran is supplying the weapons to whoever attacked our military base in the middle of nowhere at the Jordanian-Syrian border that killed 3 soldiers and wounded 34 others. We'll get to that in a minute. But I want to analyze with you what the president said. There's a lot of noise in the background, but you'll see popping up on the screen subtitles so you can hear the question and you can hear the answer.
Yes. I do hold responsible in the sense that they're supplying the weapons to the people who did it. We'll have that discussion. We'll see.
The key is I do hold Iran responsible in the sense that they're supplying the weapons. Mr. President, does that theory not keep the United States responsible for supplying the weapons in Ukraine that has resulted in the slaughter of 500,000 Ukrainian young men and supplying the weapons to the IDF that has resulted in the slaughter of 27, 28, 29,000, we don't even know how many, civilians in Gaza? Goose with that line that I'm going to hold responsible the people who supply the weapons.
Yeah, the hypocrisy is wide open there. And I'm kind of surprised that there wasn't a follow-on question by one of our brave journalists to point that out to Mr. Biden. It's exactly the same situation, or in fact, even more so, in that the United States obviously has boots on the ground. The United States is consulting with Israel on an almost weekly basis. Somebody is over there, a senior government official is in there working things out with Israel. We're totally complicit in the act. I would have thought that Biden would have been sensible enough for once to concede that unless Iran were the agent making this proxy group carry out the action, that they're not guilty. I mean, this is supplying weapons to allies and things like that is a totally normal act at most places in the world where these relationships exist. So it's, again, what is wrong with this guy? It strikes me as odd that he could not see the irony in what he was saying. Now, this is scary.
It is. It is very scary, and it gets back to what you and I talked about originally. I realize that international law is not the same as American law. But if this case were to be tried under American law, the United States would be a co-defendant. I mean,
I think Judge Napolitano has been doing sensational work here. Phil Giraldi, of course, has been a longtime commentator, totally reliable, very, very significant. Turns out that a U.S. court has concluded that Israel's assault on Gaza is a plausible case of genocide. This is a U.S. court. On dismissing the case on jurisdictional grounds, a U.S. judge implores the Biden admin to stop its unflagging support for Israel's ongoing siege of the Palestinian people in Gaza. This is from the Center for Constitutional Rights. January 31st. After a federal court heard arguments and testimony in the case of Defense for Children International, Palestine versus Biden on Friday, January 26, charging the Biden admin with failing its duty to prevent and otherwise aiding and abetting the unfolding genocide in Gaza, a federal judge found that Israel is plausibly engaging in genocide of the Palestinian people, and that the United States is providing unflagging support for the massive attack on Palestinian civilians in contravention of international law. The court decision follows the historic ruling by the International Court of Justice last Friday, which also found the Israeli government was plausibly engaged in genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza, and which issued a series of emergency measures Israel must take to end its genocidal campaign. Mark my words, Israel's not going to stop its genocidal campaign. And it's pretty clear under Biden, we're not going to stop providing them the weapons to carry it out. Meanwhile, however, the percentage of U.S. adults who think that Israel has gone too far has been surging. Support among Democrats for Biden's response to the conflict fell by 13 points between December and January. Half of U.S. adults now think Israel has gone too far in its assault on Gaza. A poll released by the AP North Center for Public Research has found that's up 10 percentage points from an earlier version of the poll conducted from November 2nd through 6th. According to the second round, from January 25th to 28th, the International Court of Justice ruled that South Africa's case accusing Israel of genocide was plausible and that Israel must take all measures within its power to avoid committing genocide. In early November, the death toll in Gaza broke 10,000. Nearly 3 months later, it surpassed 26. The United Nations estimate 40% of those killed in Israel's assault have been children. Well, the American people aren't happy about this. Meanwhile, the Democrat civil war itself is spinning out of control. A shock chant throws a Biden campaign scop into chaos. It's becoming increasingly clear Democrats are fighting over the war in Israel. Far left progressives have turned on their party. They have called Israel an oppressive regime and accused Biden of complying with genocide for supporting it, of which there is no doubt. We just heard a U.S. court confirming it. Democrats are in big trouble. They cannot turn on Israel since it's a top ally, but Biden cannot afford to lose progressives either. His campaign will have to scramble to win over these voters in the meantime. The conflict is heating up. While Biden made a campaign stop in Blue, Michigan, protesters won and agreed him with his chant from a post-millennial. On Thursday, President Biden failed to receive a warm welcome during a campaign stop in Michigan. That's a euphemism. He received a bitter opposing welcome during the campaign stop. The Democrat president was met by a furious pro-Palestinian activist screaming, F Joe Biden, in support of Gaza. Video footage published by BG on the scene shows a group of pro-Palestinian protesters chanting obscenities at Biden. There's a venue in Warren, Michigan. pro-Palestinian activists greeted him with these vicious chants. Biden has big problems brewing. He cannot renege on America's longstanding support of Israel, the only Jewish state in the world, and he cannot pull support from the nation after it was a victim of the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. But bear in mind, all that Holocaust is nonsense. Just nonsense, because we know that was what fabricated propaganda after World War II in order to justify the founding of the nation of Israel, which I think historically turns out to have been a major calamity. A major calamity. Meanwhile, get this, a judge has dismissed a Trump ballot challenge ahead of South Carolina, where we're going to have the next meeting between Nikki Haley and Donald Trump. And as I gather, Trump's out ahead by about 30 points in South Carolina, where Nikki Haley served as governor. I suspect after Trump trounces her in South Carolina that Haley will get the message and withdraw. A federal judge, this is from the Epoch Times, dismissed yet another challenge to former President Trump's eligibility as a candidate under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, this time in South Carolina ahead of the state primary this month, as a U.S. Supreme Court ruling regarding Trump's eligibility looms overhead, set to be issued in less than a week. President Trump is still litigating several ongoing challenges of this nature in state and federal jurisdictions. The South Carolina case was one of some 20 brought by John Anthony Castro, a little-known Republican candidate who was recently charged with several tax crimes. According to President Trump's attorneys, as of early January, they had encountered some 60 challenges across at least 30 states. They're desperate to deny Trump. We'll be right back and hopefully joined by my guest, Kevin Barrett. We'll be right back.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. The the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm delighted to be joined for the second hour by my dear friend and colleague, Kevin Barrett, now residing in Morocco. Kevin, among the developments we've been addressing during the first hour was Colonel McGregor's observation that the U.S. has no foreign policy, that in the Middle East, we're simply instruments or pawns or tools of Israel, and that you can best understand what's going on there by assuming the equivalent that Benjamin Netanyahu is a commander-in-chief of the American military. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the case, although it's not clear whether Netanyahu is 100% in control, maybe 65%, I would say. There are reports that immediately after the successful Palestinian raid on Israel, the breakout from their concentration camp on October 7th, that the Israelis were about to go all out against Hezbollah. And according to reports, the Biden administration or whoever's in charge in the U.S. Gave them a very firm no. But there haven't been very many firm no's given to Netanyahu and his crazy extremist co-ministers. So, yeah, they're largely in charge. I actually just published an article entitled Flashpoints for War, looking over possible places where the next world war could start. And one of them was Florida, where I said it's imagination. October 2024, polls ahead. Trump's ahead in the polls, 55 to 45%, leading in the swing states. And suddenly a drone swoops down on Mar-a-Lago, smashes through a plate glass window and stings Trump with its explosive charge. But fortunately, before what's left of Trump is declared dead, the media tells us that an Iranian Palestinian terrorist named Lee Harvey Atta did it. And so he's arrested on the seventh floor of the Palm Beach School Book Depository, but is accidentally defenestrated before he can be questioned. But fortunately, on the floor of the book depository, the authorities find an Iranian-made Mamlouk Karkano drone control rig, complete with instructions in Farsi, signed by the supreme leader of Iran. And so that then would indeed cause Biden to fly Bibi Netanyahu straight into the White House Situation Room, where he will take control, full control of U.S. policy. Anyway, hopefully there won't be one of these crazy false flag type events that would put Netanyahu in total charge. like happened on 9/11, but you never know, do you?
Well, your satirical gifts have not failed you, Kevin. I've always admired your stylistic manner of lampooning events in a way that gets right to the heart of the matter. You mentioned Florida's one location for World War breaking out. What were the other four?
Well, the others were actually kind of more obvious ones in certain. I guess the Trump, killing Trump and blaming Iran is pretty obvious too. But the other ones included the Red Sea, where we could get a kind of, instead of a Gulf of a Persian Gulf of Tonkin incident, which we've all been waiting for what 20 years now, we could get a Red Sea Gulf of Tonkin incident. An American ship could go down. It could be blamed on the Houthis, whether or not they actually did it. And of course, it would be blamed on Iran as well. And then another possibility, of course, would be another of these kinds of attacks from, you know, the Qatar forces or other militias in Iraq or Syria, you know, any of those that did a whole lot of damage, killed a lot of Americans, might work. Then, of course, within Palestine itself, there's always the possibility of some kind of big event happening. Right now, the world, you know, so much of the world is so angry at the Zionist genocide that it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, actual no return address WMD suddenly went off inside of Israel. And I mean, that might very likely, you know, wouldn't have to be a false flag. It could be true. And other flashpoints, of course, include Ukraine and Taiwan. In Ukraine, Zelensky's faction, the fanatics, they don't want to give up. So the only way they even have a chance is to drag NATO into it, and that would take a big false flag, like maybe a nuke blamed on Russia. And then over in Taiwan, the final flashpoint that I listed, clearly, now that's the big, you know, that's the big kahuna, would be the number one power, the U.S., versus the rising number two power, China. And the Americans have been provoking the Chinese and poking the dragon for years. And if they poked hard enough, the dragon might bite back, and we'd be off to the races for a big World War III between the number one, formerly number one power, and the rising number two power that would probably become number one in the aftermath.
Do you know that Oliver Stone has made a wonderful statement denouncing Netanyahu? I mean, very emphatic. I've been totally impressed by what he had to say. I'll pull it up and share it with you as soon as I can find it. Here we have. Check this out, Kevin. Oliver Stone. Netanyahu is a madman. I repeat that. To me, he's a madman. I met him years ago. I interviewed him when he was out of office. I thought he was a madman then, and I think he's gotten worse and worse. He's truly insane. I've never seen such slaughter being justified like this as revenge. How do you wipe out a political movement? It's never been done in the history of the world. How are you going to kill off everybody? What do you do? Separate them, send them to Egypt? It's just mad, the whole solution. And what was sickening to me was when Biden went over there, hat in hand, money in hand, to give him what he wanted. This is the problem with our country. In that regard, I think Trump, although he supported Israel to a max and made quite a few mistakes in that regard, has better choices to make. We can't do this. We can't constantly support Israel. We have to say no, cut them off, cut off everything to them right now. That's what I would do. And don't give me this anti-Semitic shit. I mean, I don't even know what they're talking about. Who are the anti-Semites in the world? Just a few nutcases. Nobody's an anti-Semite unless they have a problem with Hitler and all that. But this is an issue about justice and peace and balance and basic human decency. Kevin, I've never been more proud of Oliver Stone. What a wonderful statement. When most of Hollywood is, of course, just singing the usual Jewish hymn.
Yeah, I think Oliver Stone is basically a reasonably good guy. And, you know, I've had this argument with Laurent Guyonneau, who wrote the book JFK 9/11 and has written articles such as 9/11 was an Israeli job and did Israel kill the Kennedys? And the answer, of course, in his mind is very likely yes. And so he argues that Oliver Stone's JFK film was actually kind of a distraction. It was financed and produced by Arnold Milchan, who was a self-confessed Israeli nuclear weapons smuggler who helped organized crime steal American nukes and send them over to Israel. So having that guy produce the film JFK and leave out any whisper of possible Israeli involvement in murdering President Kennedy was, in Laurent's mind, it was suspicious. But I don't think Oliver Stone understood that that was the case. I think he was steered into the same path that we all were back then, which was focusing on the CIA and Vietnam and Cuba and such, and not so much on Israel. I think he was perfectly sincere. And maybe, Milchan probably wasn't. Maybe Milchan sort of hoodwinked him and helped steer him. But I think Oliver Stone's a very good guy, basically honest, quite bright, and has been on the right path, saying the right things about a lot of things, Ukraine. And now I think he's right about Netanyahu. But unfortunately, it's not just Netanyahu. The whole Israeli society has gone mad. The polls are showing 95% plus Israeli Jewish support for this genocide. So it's a whole national psychosis, and Netanyahu just kind of symbolizes it.
I played a clip where Judge Napolitano was interviewing Phil Giraldi, and he included where Biden was questioned about responding to the attack that killed the three U.S. servicemen in Jordan just over the border. And saying that, he holds Iran responsible because Iran has been providing the weapons. And what the judge was pointing out is that seemed to be quite a slip on Biden's part, because we're supplying the weapons for Ukraine. We're supplying the weapons for Israel to slaughter Palestinians in Gaza. And he was asking, why not an intrepid follow-up question to ask, well, doesn't that mean then that the United States is responsible for genocide in Gaza, which you and I both know to be the case, but where is the national media confronting Biden with this grim reality?
Well, of course, the American neocons who run the empire these days are frustrated about Iran, because Iran is kind of the heart of this axis of resistance, but it doesn't run the other members. The way the axis of resistance works is that each group is totally independent. They all receive financing and help and arms and things like that from multiple sources, not just Iran. We saw that, of course, with Hamas. Hamas's major funding was not from Iran, even though it's part of the axis of resistance too. Hamas's major funding was actually from Qatar, with the blessings of the Israelis, who escorted the suitcases full of cash into Gaza to hand it to Hamas. So each of these groups in the axis of resistance, the multiple kinds of militias, branches, really they're de facto branches of the Iraqi military. There's Hezbollah, which is a de facto leader of the Lebanese military. And then there's the Houthi movement, which is a de facto government of Yemen. All of these forces are loosely allied with Tehran, because all of them want justice for Palestine and they want the U.S. to leave the region. But Iran doesn't tell them what to do. Iran has a certain amount of leverage due to its support, but with Hamas's October 7th operation, Al-Aqsa Storm, they didn't even tell the Iranians that they were going to do it. It's pretty much all sources agree that it came as a surprise to Tehran. And that the Iranians were even a little miffed about that, because they like, wait a minute, you just started what could turn into World War III and you didn't even ask us our opinion first. So the thing is, it's Iran doesn't control these groups. And so Iran shouldn't be blamed when an Iraqi paramilitary group, is targeting American bases. That's not Iran's fault. It's the fault of the Americans who invaded this region, are illegally operating in Iraq, occupying Iraq and Syria, which in itself is a war crime, among all these other war crimes, including the crimes of aggression when the U.S. invaded Iraq, and also Syria, for that matter. So it's a situation where the American neocons are frustrated because, what are they going to do? They've got all of these forces. The vast majority of public opinion in the region is actually supporting the goals of the Axis of Resistance, which are the liberation of Palestine and chasing the Americans out. And so all these groups are working for those ends. And the Americans are frustrated. What can they do? Well, they can, the Bibi Netanyahu wants to they call it cutting off the head of the snake, which means going after Iran, which is the most powerful member of this axis of independent entities that all agree with the 95% plus of the people of the region that Palestine needs to be liberated and the U.S. needs to be out of the region.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, one of the flashpoints, of course, being the Red Sea. My wife, addicted to MSNBC, I was captivated by, I think it may have been John Kirby talking about the situation there, or the MSNBC anchor saying how the U.S. was retaliating against the Houthis because they were interfering with international shipping and in violation of international law, without ever mentioning that the Houthis had declared war on Israel, that the Houthis were only interdicting shipping that had cargo destined for Israel, that it was the Houthis who were acting in accordance with international law, and the U.S. and the U.K. that were violating it by simply suppressing the most basic predicates on which action is being based. They give a 100% distorted view of what's going on there, Kevin. I so admire the Houthis and stand with them, and yet they're having to suffer, you know, ongoing bombardment by the U.S. and the U.K., which is taking place in violation of international law, the Geneva Convention, the laws of war, and all the rest. It is shameful.
Well, I think the Houthis have a pretty good argument that they are enforcing the World Court's judgment that has ordered the Israeli government to stop any acts of genocide that appear to be going on there. And that order is being flouted by the Israeli leadership, which has continued to massacre the same 100 plus, up to averaging 200 at times, people per day, most of them innocent civilians, the majority women and children, while the Israeli leaders continue to make genocidal statements that they're just going to clear, you know, get rid of everybody. And so the Houthis are actually the enforcement arm, and really the only serious enforcement arm right now, of the International Court of Justice. So it's the U.S. that's violating international law by supporting genocide. And obviously, in this case, you know, if we had an impartial international law system, the American leaders would all be tried, convicted, and probably executed alongside their Israeli genocidal counterparts. And then the Houthis would be, you know, wearing the badge of enforcing the law.
And of course, if the U.S. think the Houthis are going to be a pushover, they have another thing coming. I mean, they've sustained like around 8 years of bombing by Saudi Arabia, which was supplied with American weapons, probably even American pilots. So this is really a continuation of what's happened before. Not only that, but the Houthis prevailed. They were able to work out a tentative peace agreement with Saudi Arabia, where the Houthis would take the north and the Saudis the south, which happens to be the oil-rich region, but where the Houthis have never been in it for financial reasons. I got to say, Kevin, for the poorest nation in Africa, that the Houthis are setting a hell of a moral example. I mean, they are exemplary, and I applaud them. They are heroic.
Yeah, I agree. Now, they're not in Africa. They're across the Red Sea from Africa. But yeah, they're very poor. They're probably the poorest nation in the region, especially after the suffering that they've had to undergo since this crazy U.S. supported and instigated. Well, maybe not instigated. There's dispute about what the then Obama administration's viewpoint was about the launching the war on Yemen from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. But the Yemeni people, they have really suffered horribly. They've been undergoing the kind of suffering that now we're seeing in Palestine. Maybe the bombardment hasn't been quite as extreme in Yemen, but it's been pretty bad. And then the cutoff of the means of life, the water supply, the food supply, the sewage systems, and so on and so forth, has also been going on for many, many years in Yemen. And I forget the exact number of estimated dead, but it's actually much greater than we've had so far in Palestine. So Yemen has been horribly mistreated by this global neocon empire. And I think that's one reason that they are working to support the Palestinian genocide victims right now, because they understand that kind of suffering. And so they want to stop it.
Yes, yes, I have no end of praise for the Houthis, and here you have the Israelis practicing genocide on the Palestinians by means of starvation with a siege they imposed after 7 October. No food, no water, no fuel, for the most part, no communication, and it's starting to take a toll. I gather a lot of Palestinians are on the verge of starvation. And, of course, I mentioned the rule of three, that a human being can go 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. Well, it's now been a hell of a long time. What do we have, 120 days of this siege, Kevin? It is outrageous. It is monstrous. And I can't understand how any decent human being could possibly support it and not be vehemently opposed to Israel.
Yeah, I agree, Jim. And you know, I'm going to say something maybe a little controversial now, but it just occurred to me that I wonder, you know, people say, well, the state of Israel was supposedly basically legitimized and became a state because of the Holocaust, right? That everybody around the world made a huge exception for the Jews because, and nowhere else would you ever allow this group of settler colonialists to travel thousands of miles across the seas and, you know, basically displace or murder and expel the indigenous people and call themselves a country and claim that they have the right to do that because they allegedly had ancestors there thousands of years ago, which actually they probably didn't, but that's another story. In any case, that's just so insane that nobody would ever be allowed to do that, except because of the story of the Holocaust at that time. Supposedly an exception was made for the Jewish people to have their Jewish state in what they claimed was thousands of years ago Jewish land. But I wonder, you know, the whole never again slogan that emerged from the Holocaust, that, you know, Jews of all over the world have always said never again, never again, never again. And people, you know, Jews like Samantha Power, Cass Sunstein's wife, have made a whole, you know, career of saying that we need these humanitarian interventions. And in fact, I have to look at what's, you know, Israeli behavior. And it occurs to me to question whether the Jewish people in Israel even really believe that there really was a Holocaust. And that, because if they did, if they really actually believed the reality, the historical reality of that kind of suffering that Jews underwent, in fact, you know, regardless of what we think about might have happened there, obviously there was a tremendous amount of suffering. But if indeed it was as off the charts as the standard Holocaust narrative tells us it was, with 6 million dead, most of them killed in gas chambers, as part of a deliberate plan to try to exterminate all Jewish people, if not on earth, at least within reach of the Reich. If that had been the case, that, you know, that would have been, again, so horrible as the official Holocaust narrative tells us it was, that you would really think that Israeli Jews would be very aware of the horror of genocide, genocidal campaigns to exterminate populations, get rid of populations, which is what was supposedly done to them. But I have to wonder, Jim, whether those Israeli Jews really believe the Holocaust narrative. Because, of course, as you and I know, we've both looked at the, I don't know how much study you've put into it, but I've read a number of books, including books by Holocaust revisionists and books that attempt to refute the Holocaust revisionists. And obviously the Holocaust revisionists have a pretty good case. That is, the whole 6 million dead, mostly in gas chambers, as part of a deliberate extermination plan, officially, you know, in the German bureaucracy. Well, it's more likely than not that those three, you know, the Holy Trinity of the Orthodox Holocaust narrative is just not true, and that the reality was a lot less than that, and that we got that exaggerated version due to wartime propaganda that then somehow survived the war. And so, if indeed at some level, you know, I think the smart Jewish people know this. Philip Zelikow, for example, who talks about public myths, I think he knows that the Holocaust was very likely not nearly what the official myth tells us it was. And he knows that's a public myth, which he defines as a belief that people have in common that motivates their political and social behavior, but may or may not be true. And I wonder if not just the intellectuals like Zelikow and the specialists, but also it kind of filters down to the Israeli people. Maybe they realize, based on the kinds of complete nonsense that they've been fed, we've seen this in the documentary, defamation, which Israeli children being brainwashed just absurdly with all this insane Holocaust propaganda. I recently learned from a Ron Unz article on this topic that in the 1960s and 70s, the most popular, there was this huge wave of Holocaust pornography in Israel, and that like huge numbers of Israelis were getting off on watching, you know, Nazis rape and torture Jews, and then Jews rape and kill Nazis in revenge. That was what got them excited sexually, apparently. There's something weird about this. I think that at some level, the Jewish Israelis actually know that they're liars, that they founded Israel on a whole series of lies, including the story, the maximal story of the Holocaust. And that's why they're perfectly happy to do another genocide, because they know that the supposed genocide that was done to them didn't happen, or at least it didn't happen to the extent that their extreme myth of the Holocaust tells us it did. So, I mean, am I crazy to think this? I mean, but could it be that it's not so much this extreme belief in the Holocaust, but it's actually that at some level they know that they're completely full of shit that explains their insanity?
Kevin, you're spot on. I wrote the introduction to Nick Holerstrom's Breaking the Spell, which may be the most important book on the genocide myth, because he had access to the British death books. They had cracked the German code, so they had all the records from all the camps confirming the results of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which was keeping meticulous records on the age, the sex, the ethnicity, the religion, and the cause of death of all the inmates, where in 1993 they recalibrated the total, 296,081 from all causes, none of whom were put to death in gas chambers using Zyklon B, which was in fact being used to kill body lice, which was spreading typhus and dysentery in the camps. In other words, to preserve the health of the inmates, for the obvious reason you can't get work out of a corpse. We'll be right back with my special guest, Kevin Barrett, right after this break.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Continuing a conversation with Kevin Barrett, my dear friend and colleague who now resides in Morocco. And of course, Kevin, as I know you're aware, during the trials of Ernst Sundell in Canada for Holocaust denial, distributing the pamphlet, Did 6 Million Really Die? In 1985, the first trial was distinguished by the prosecution failure to be able to produce a single witness who could testify they had seen anyone put to death in a gas chamber, zilch, nada, zero, none. In the second, 1988, for the Lochter Report, where Fred Lochter, the leading expert on gas chambers, visited the camps and came back with a report explaining there was nothing there at any of the camps that could have remotely served the function of a gas chamber. Where Fred is still alive and well, remarkably, he spoke at my flag and conspiracy conference for 2023, Kevin, and I recently featured him right here on The Raw Deal, where you are my guest today, elaborating, and he, you know, reviews the bidding. It's just a monstrous myth, and I put it this way, if you've done the research, then you're either a Holocaust denier or a big fat liar.
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's quite that stark. I guess it depends maybe how much research. You know, I haven't done enough research to have a firm, you know, grip on the whole issue. But I've done enough to see that the revisionists have a really strong prima facie case. And it doesn't take very much, you know, to figure that out. I mean, just you read a few of these introductory books by the revisionists. You mentioned Nick Kollerstrom, and that's very good stuff. And I've read a few others. There's Debating the Holocaust by Thomas Dalton. And Ron Unz's stuff on this is really good, too.
Robert Forrestone.
Forrestone, yeah. Yeah, I've read a little bit of him and so on. And then I read the two leading attempts to respond to the revisionists in the sort of popular history format. You know, one was Denial by Deborah Lipstadt, which is unbelievably bad. It's almost as if Deborah Lipstadt and her publishers and supporters, whoever's putting her up to this, is actually covertly trying to support the revisionists, because it's just awful. It's nothing but sort of histrionic emotional wailing with no good factual basis. You know, there's no coherent argument. The references aren't convincing. You know, it's just a textbook case of, you know, fallacy and incoherence. And so then let's turn to the other well-known one that sold a fair bit is called Denying History by Michael Shermer, and I think the other guy was Grobman. And that is better, much better than Lipstadt, which isn't saying much, but it's still not very convincing. And in fact, it runs into some of the kind of obvious problems, like if the Auschwitz plaque had to be changed, and it sunk from like 4.5 million people were gassed here to, what was it, like 1 something million were gassed here. They lost like 2.5-3 million supposed Holocaust victims overnight. How do the defenders of the Orthodox position refute that? Well, Shermer and Grobman refute it by saying that, well, it just so happens that at the exact moment that we lost, you know, 2.5 or 3 million Holocaust victims, it turned out they didn't really get gassed at Auschwitz. But right at about the same time that that was discovered, we learned that exactly that same number of Jews had in fact been killed on the Eastern Front. We didn't realize that there had been all, you know, that same number. Suddenly we got an extra 2.5 to 3 million victims who had, we just discovered, had been killed on the Eastern Front. We didn't know that before. Now, to me, that's not a very convincing argument, to say the least. And there are a lot of other examples, too. So, again, you know, when you do the basic research and you compare the best you can find from both sides, and honestly, in terms of stuff that's actually been published and widely distributed in the English-speaking world in book form, I don't think, I don't know what else there is. You know, where is there a really good defense of Holocaust orthodoxy? And I've asked this question repeatedly, and nobody's been able to answer it, not even people who've come on my radio show and given a better argument than I ever saw from people like Lipstadt and Shermer and Grobman. So my conclusion, even though, you know, I'm not a professional historian, I've just read, you know, I've read the same, you know, 30 or 50 World War II books everybody else has, plus these, you know, sort of intro to revisionism pro and con. But just based on that, it's just obvious that the revisionists have a good prima facie case. And therefore, locking people up in prison because they support the case that seems stronger makes you suspect that the whole reason that they are, you know, imprisoning historians for taking the wrong position on this is because if they didn't do that, the dam would break. And the fact that we've been, if not hoaxed, at least been fed a really exaggerated war propaganda narrative all these decades would become obvious. And then what would that mean for the future of Israel?
And right home at, here at home now, we've just had released this new package of proposals for border policies that turn out to allow legalized, Kevin, 1.5 million illegals per year, sides up to 2.38 billion to NGOs that are supporting the illegals, giving, of course, $60 billion to Ukraine and $14 or so to Israel. It seems to me it's just a sellout, and that there's an Oklahoma senator named Langford who has promoted this plan, but it's really just making illegal immigration legal, and it gives Biden or the president all kinds of ways to allow it to surge. I find this outrageous and insulting. And we have members of the House who have declared now they're not going to allow this bill to pass. Trump himself has said he'd rather have no bill than a bad bill. He's, of course, also declared that if he becomes president again, he's going to undertake the greatest deportation program in the history of America. I believe him. I think that's what we need. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, you and I have somewhat different perspectives on this one, because I think, like, actually, I understand the good arguments for tighter border control and reducing immigration to the United States and certain other countries as well. I fully understand that, and I probably agree with that position, but I am alienated by the bad arguments in favor of restricting immigration coming from, well, including people like Donald Trump, who harped on the supposed horrible criminality of all these Hispanic people coming across the border. And in fact, statistics show that's just not the case, that the crime rates are not going up because of these immigrants across the Hispanic border. And the same is maybe true to a lesser extent in Europe, where the anti-immigration forces are kind of hysteria. They're full of, you know, hysteria in decrying the crimes of immigrants. Now, in Europe, I think there may be a case that immigrants do commit an unusual share of the crimes in some of these countries. But if you adjust for the, you know, age and gender, it's not nearly as disproportionate as it might look at first. It just so happens that in some of these European countries, hardly anybody has been having kids for a generation or so. So now if you look at, you know, all of the total population of 20-year-old males, you know, you end up with an awful lot of them being immigrants. And 20-year-old males are the people that have the high crime rate. So you adjust for the, you know, age and gender, and then you could adjust for economic status as well. And at the end of that adjustment, you would find that immigrants aren't really that much worse than anybody else in terms of crime. And so this wailing and gnashing of teeth about the evil, criminal, dark-skinned immigrants, it is racist and disgusting and obnoxious. There are all kinds of lies being peddled about it. For instance, the story about the mass rapes that happened on New Year's Eve in Cologne, Germany, have been persuasively, I think, exposed as a complete hoax by Jonathan Ravuski. Certainly, the high northern Russia incident, where supposedly the heroic white people like beat up the evil dark skinned immigrants who were going to try to rape some women, that was all obviously a hoax, a Murmansk hoax. And then there's all this hoax of these supposed no go zones. Now, Jim, you may remember you and me and Nick Kollerstrom walking around in these really pretty, you know, down and out sections of London, going to mosques where we were going to try to persuade the Muslims to come see our 9/11 truth event. And those were not no-go zones. And yet that's the kind of place that these idiot anti-immigration racist propagandists keep pointing at as, you know, oh, no white person would ever dare set foot there. And so I've issued a challenge over it's been standing for like 8 or 10 years now that please tell me where there is a single no-go zone in Europe where a white guy like me couldn't just show up. And I will go there. You put up, you know, pay my travel expenses and even as low as just a $1,000 premium to cover my time. And I'll go to that no-go zone and I'll get on the phone or internet with you and we'll do a little chat and I'll be standing there in a no-go zone. I'll hang out for the no-go zone for as long as you like. And you'll see that there's no such thing as a no-go zone. So these lies and this racist garbage coming from the anti-immigration side just repels sane and decent people. They need to stop that, and they need to start giving us the good arguments against excessive immigration.
Well, what are the good arguments, Kevin? I don't want you to leave the impression or my inadvertently allow it that you think open borders is a good idea. I mean, every economist in the world agrees you cannot combine open borders with a welfare state. These immigrants are being given all kinds of inducements. Millions of dollars are being used by DHS and UN to bring them here in convoys. I even have video of trucks bringing migrants to the border where they have on their door the Star of David. We know this is implementing the Kalergi plan. Brett, you could comment on that as the bigger picture combined with Powered Blinken plan to destroy America by overloading the welfare system to cause it to collapse.
Well, yeah, I think the best arguments against immigration are, number one, as you say, it's incompatible with a welfare system. That is, it's hard to take care of your own people when you're being flooded with workers competing for jobs with those people. And that's why the biggest corporations and the richest individuals are the biggest supporters of open borders. And historically, labor unions have generally been against the open borders. And so concern for ordinary working people, such as the majority of African Americans in the United States, is a really good reason to close the borders or greatly reduce the immigration rate. That way, you're going to have higher wages for working people, and then you can also have a better social safety net because it won't have millions and millions of people swarming in to join that social safety, or, you know, to be part of the group that either works or is in the social safety net. And that's number one. And then the other argument, I think, is that right now the rate of immigration in some places is so high that it's a threat to social stability. It's just normal that if you are replacing the majority ethnic group of a particular country that they're not going to like it. And some of them are going to get very angry. And then you almost can't blame them for going into racist hysteria, right? So, I mean, I was kind of hard on them before, but I can kind of see how, like, these Irishmen feel. My, you know, John Waters, who's been on my radio show, is really upset that the Irish are going to be a minority in their own country, possibly as early as 2030, because the Irish government is just chipping in so many refugees and other immigrants. So I think that's a good argument, too, is that immigration rates need to be calibrated in such a way that they don't overwhelm the population of the country. So those, I think, are really the good arguments. And then on the other side, we have to admit that the real argument for immigration is not so much all of these, I think some of these conspiracy theories, and I use that term knowing full well that a great many, perhaps most so-called conspiracy theories are actually true. But in this case, I think the notion that the whole point of bringing in the immigrants is to bring in Democrats to vote Democratic in the U.S. and so on. And then, you know, in Europe, there are these theories that they're, it's all a Muslim conspiracy or something, or, you know, there are all of these interesting ideas that I can't quite make out how they would work in reality. I think that stuff is secondary to the fact that the one actual reasonably good reason to bring in a lot of immigrants is because white people have stopped breeding. In Europe, the child per woman birth rate is down to about one. You know, that's like bringing on population collapse. And so if you're the leader of the European Union, you look at that and you say, you know, nobody's shown us that it's possible to quickly increase birth rates, even if you wanted to. And since there are all these people who would like to come here and work and pay the Social Security taxes that will allow the grossly top-heavy population of oldsters in these countries, the baby boomers, to retire and still get their pensions, then it's really the only option. There's just no other way. And so that's the good argument in favor of high immigration rates. We have to acknowledge that.
Well, in Morocco, you may be unaware that in Chicago and New York, there are lots of protests that they're being overwhelmed, that they can't handle the surge. They got airports where they're housing migrants or taking over high schools or getting the students out, putting the migrants in. They don't have the money to cope with it. It's overwhelming the hospitals in Denver. The largest hospital can't cope with a massive number of migrants. I mean, surely that represents a threat to the nation's security. It seems to me, if the United States were simply to adopt the migration policies of Mexico, principally two, number one, you can only migrate to Mexico if you have something to contribute to the good of Mexico, like being a carpenter, a plumber, a lawyer, a doctor. Number two, you can only migrate to Mexico if you have the financial resources to support yourself and your family members so you don't become a burden on the state. Those two simple principles, it seemed to me, if adopted by the United States, would solve the problem. The Democrats are going whole hog, and they're actually, this is part and parcel, in my judgment, of the George Soros dream to destroy America by, you know, changing the demographic so substantially that we're going to have the same result as you spoke of in Ireland, where Americans are going to be a minority, you know, and it's not that far off at the rate at which this is taking place. It's really, to me, completely outrageous. Your further thought.
Yeah, well, I agree with a whole lot of that. I don't understand why it's necessary to not only allow illegal immigration, but then actively encourage it. That doesn't make sense to me. Obviously, governments should try to make sure that the whatever immigration they have is legal. I mean, that's, and I think this is part of the reason that there's such a strong anti-immigration movement, is that people see that this is just insane. Like, I mean, just from a personal standpoint, I've traveled around the world and I can't just cross borders without showing my papers. I mean, it's kind of a nice dream, right? You know, imagine all the people crossing borders without their passports. I love it. There's something appealing about that. But the fact is, that as long as we have this system that forces you and I to go jump through all these hoops. I mean, you should have seen the hoops I had to jump through just to bring my freaking cat to Morocco.
Yeah.
And that was the fault of the U.S. government. You know, it required multiple appointments, you know, spend $1,000, jab the cat multiple times, keep bringing the cat into the vet and getting, you know, chipping and stuff. And oh, man, it was just nuts. And likewise, all of the paper, you know, we've had to go through and all of the immigration stuff and getting residency permits in Morocco, which we're doing, by the way. We're not just, you know, swimming to the beach here in Saidia from a boat and taking up residence here without, you know, without doing it legally. Of course not. People shouldn't do that. So, yeah, I mean, I totally understand the people who say there should be zero illegal immigration. Anybody that tries to come across illegally should be stopped and sent back. Yeah, that makes good sense. And then the argument is about, well, then, you know, how do you run the legal immigration system? And I think what those two points you mentioned about Mexico's policy make pretty good sense. And I'm sure there are probably a few other things that could be added. But yeah, no, I'm basically in agreement with that. And I think the vast majority of Americans would agree that there's really no reason why anybody should be tolerating any illegal immigration.
Just a couple of thoughts about the 2024 election. There's, I think, no doubt Trump will be the GOP nominee. There's also, in my opinion, no doubt Democrats are going to try to steal the election again, but they cannot do it with Joe Biden. His popularity has sunk to such a low point that if Biden were to be reelected, no one would believe it. I have concluded that between Super Tuesday and the Democrat convention in Chicago, Biden is going to step out of the arena, possibly pardoning Hunter in the process, to be replaced by Kevin Newsom and Michelle Obama, probably the combination. Michelle's been making noises about her desire to run for president. I think that could be quite embarrassing, given that Michelle Obama is actually a man with breast implants. But what do you see forthcoming here with this election, where it could be that a border crisis precipitates what's viewed as a civil war, martial law is declared, and the election is suspended? Your thoughts about all of the above?
Yeah, I think it's looking pretty chaotic. We've had neocons like Robert Kagan. You know, he penned an article for the Washington Post, essentially, you know, all but calling for the assassination of Donald Trump. You know, I think the headline was something like, you know, we can't wait one more minute. Trump's election is looking increasingly inevitable. And a close reading of that article is, I was, I think, the first to point out, and then lots of other pointed the same thing out after that. It sure sounded like a call for Trump's assassination. So there are some really high feelings running around this election.
Yes, yes, yes. But who do you foresee to be the Democrat nominee? Who do you think their slate will be? Do you think they could possibly run with the fake Biden? Remember, I mean, the real Joe appears to have died in 2017. By my assessment, we've had at least four different candidates playing the role of Joe Biden. Do you think there's any reason to think the Democrats would try to run with him again?
Well, Jim, I'm skeptical about the Biden replacement hypothesis, because whoever they keep replacing him with is even a little bit more senile than the previous version. So you would think that they would actually, you know, try to tune him up a little bit if they were replacing him. They build one of those Disney presidential androids that could do better than this. We're seeing this guy too. But in any case, you're right. Whether it's just a series of replacement robot Bidens that keep breaking down worse and worse, which is like a scene out of a Philip K. Dick novel, or whether it's just Biden himself wearing out, and for some reason his earlobes look different in different pictures. I don't know. But I don't see Biden as being very electable, and he's really torpedoed his chances by going along with the Israelis as much as he has. He's really unpopular within his own party because of that. And of course, the other party doesn't like him anyway. So his numbers are down in kind of unprecedentedly bad areas. And yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats find a way to dump him. And, you know, Michelle Obama and Gavin Newsom sounds like a dream to the Democrats. It sounds like a scene from hell to me.
I agree. Newsom.
Yeah, I'm just kind of glad I'm out of there.
Yeah, Rocco, I get it. And right. Having been born and raised in Southern California, of course, to see the destruction of the Golden State under these Democrat governors is tragic. And the lawlessness, you know, major stores are shutting up in these Democrat cities because the crime rate has become so high. And when you lose the stores, you lose the revenue. So there's not as much tax money to fund public services. So it's kind of a death spiral, that defunding the police and getting rid of bail and, you know, not prosecuting for shoplifting up to $950. All this has been brought on by policies. And it seems to me it's awfully difficult to see how they can be reversed.
Yeah, it's well, they're that policies are pretty bad on both sides. With the Trump administration, had you know, they gave the richest taxpayers a huge bonus. And of course, Trump killed General Soleimani and gave Bibi Netanyahu Jerusalem on a silver platter and pushed these insane, sick, demonic Abraham Accords on countries such as Morocco, where I live, among others. And so Trump's policies actually produced the current genocide in Palestine. Had there been no Abraham Accords, no moving to Jerusalem, if Trump had taken a position at least as, you know, quote unquote moderate regarding Netanyahu as Obama did and as Biden has, I don't think there would be this genocide right now. So, you know, this Trump line that if I were president, this wouldn't have happened. It's the opposite. You did it, Trump. You created this.
My interpretation has been it's a failure of Ukraine to prevail, where Ukraine was destined to be the new Israel that has led to the mopping up of the desire to get rid of all Palestinians out of Palestine. Whereas you've heard me say before, no doubt, the ultimate solution from the Israeli point of view is to load all the Palestinians aboard a ship, float it out to sea and sink it. They're now doing the equivalent, and God only knows when it's going to be brought to a halt, Kevin. Do you have any optimism at all about ending the genocide?
Well, it's going to end one way or another. And I don't think the Israelis will get away with killing everybody. And the Gazans aren't going anywhere. And nobody's going to, you know, Egypt's not going to open up the crossing, even if the Gazans were willing to cross it, which they aren't. They'll die where they are. And even if the Israelis were somehow able to get some of the, you know, most starving people to sort of totter across the border, or, you know, get lifted onto boats, the majority of a huge number of people would stay in Gaza, and that would include all of the most militant people. I mean, all of the ones who were most absolutely determined, you know, to stay and fight to the last. So it's not going to work. The Israelis have lost. They've lost militarily. They can't stop the Palestinian resistance. And ultimately, the world's going to change. The global south is going to take over. The American empire is going to die, and Israel will die with it.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me in the Brian Roux Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is Advanced Ancient Global Civilizations. Join me on the Brian Roux Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Industrial Complex podcast here on Revolution Radio, Studio B, every Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Get fit, empowered, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
My name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction. On Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion.